This is the Medical Beat on 97.1 FM Talk.
All right. Hello, everybody. Hello, St. Louis. You're listening to the Medical Beat, 97.1 FM Talk. I'm your host, Dr. Steve Harvey. The topic today is psychosis, especially psychosis in younger people. And we're talking children, adolescents, and young adults. We're going to talk about what is psychosis, what do we know about what causes it, what does it look like, how is it treated, and what's the latest research that's going on in all this. So we have a very special guest today. We have Dr. Daniel Mama from the Washington University School of Medicine. Dr. Mama is an associate professor in the Department of Psychiatry. He has a lot of published research in this area, and currently he's the director of the Washington Early Recognition Center, which is a clinic and also a research center that focuses on exactly this. So we have a whole bunch to talk about here. First of all, hi, Dr. Mama. Good morning. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. How are you doing?
Not too bad.
Good. Hey, thank you so much for being on the show. This is going to be very exciting. I can feel the excitement through the airwaves here. Everyone wants to hear about this.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. No pressure. So I guess the first thing I wanted to ask about is, can you tell us about the Washington Early Recognition Center? What is that?
Yeah, so the Washington Early Recognition Center, or WERC, as we call it, that's the abbreviation.
Clever.
is a specialized clinic that focuses on early psychosis. So we try to provide very unique care to individuals who are, you know, either at an early stage of a psychotic disorder, like schizophrenia or schizoaffective disorder or some psychotic forms of bipolar disorder, or people who maybe beginning to experience psychotic symptoms.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess at the clinic, it's both treatment and also you have some research going on there, which we'll talk more about later. But it's both treatment and research. So, yeah. And I guess so that the listeners know, can you kind of explain what is psychosis? Can you explain that for everybody?
Yeah, so psychosis is a clinical term that is used to describe a break with reality.
Yeah.
Right. So when someone is psychotic, they have a difficult time differentiating reality from non-reality. So how does that manifest in clinically, what you may have is someone who is very suspicious. So they may begin to, suspect people around them of doing things that don't really appear to make sense to others.
Yeah.
Or they may have these paranoid experiences where, you know, they feel like someone is trying to hurt them when that doesn't seem to be the case.
Right.
Or they may even have hallucinations. Auditory hallucinations where they may hear voices or sounds that other people don't hear, or they may have visual hallucinations where they'll see things, people, shadows, things like that other people don't see. So it's really a break with reality.
Yeah, so it includes things like seeing stuff that's not really there, hearing stuff that's not really there.
Exactly.
Yeah, and possibly false beliefs, like, you know, the CIA is following me, or space aliens are zapping stuff into my head, or stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I guess it's good for listeners to know that, because I guess like in popular language, you know, sometimes psychotic people think that means violent, but it does not mean violent. Is that correct? It's really not violence, and it's not just wacky crazy, but it's more specific, like hearing stuff, seeing stuff. And I guess they have other symptoms too, like trouble thinking straight and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you have a difficulty telling what is real from what is not real, your behavior oftentimes changes. You may end up doing things that that make sense to you as the person experiencing the psychosis, but right. not to other people. So,
yeah.
so someone who is psychotic oftentimes has a lot of other symptoms in addition to these beliefs.
Right. Yeah. And I guess someone with psychosis, that's usually very, very impairing. I can imagine it's hard to have friends or go to school or anything like that if you're psychotic.
Absolutely. I mean, it can definitely create a lot of challenges. But of course, when we're talking about psychosis, there are, a range of, there are a spectrum of psychotic type symptoms. Some are more severe than others. Hmm. But yes, in general, if you have significant psychotic symptoms, it can be very impairing.
Yeah. Can you tell us kind of like a typical average story of someone who presents to your clinic for treatment? What kind of a scenario is like a common scenario there?
Well, typically what happens is that it's usually a teenager or someone in their early 20s. Mm-hmm. And that's typically when psychotic disorders like schizophrenia first tend to manifest.
Mm-hmm.
And what you would typically get is oftentimes it's a family member that may notice that there's a change in the behavior of this young person.
Yeah.
Maybe the young person is beginning to be more socially isolated. Maybe their grades in school are dropping, and these things are very uncharacteristic for that person.
So a lot of times, mom or dad are bringing them in, I guess. Yeah,
absolutely. And, the parents are, they're not quite sure what is going on. The person is becoming more suspicious and just kind of doing things that seem very odd for that individual. And oftentimes there are other things associated with the state. Sometimes there's drug use, depression, anxiety. But there are these clear, psychotic type experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow they find our clinic and that's typically how they would come in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess I've heard a lot of people say that early intervention is especially important, that their overall outcome, is that true, that their overall outcome is going to be a lot? Oh, you'll need to give me a quick answer because Chad's playing the music in the background. But I guess early intervention, is that a good thing?
It is a good thing. And this is not unique to psychiatry. I mean, obviously in medicine, the earlier you intervene and, whether it's diabetes or high blood pressure or heart problems, the tendency is for outcomes to be much better. It's not much different in psychosis and psychiatric problems.
Yeah, change course early and get a better path. Yeah. Okay.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, hey, we've got to go out on break. We're going to be back in just a little bit talking to Dr. Daniel Mama, talking about early psychosis, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to The Medical Beat.
All right, we're back. This is The Medical Beat. I'm your host, Dr. Steve Harvey. It's 97.1 FM Talk. And our topic today is psychosis in younger people. If you missed the first part of this show, then first of all, what were you thinking? But second of all, don't despair. We're gonna help you catch up here. We've been talking about psychosis in younger people, children, adolescents, young adults, like early 20s. And we have here with us Dr. Daniel Mama, who is from the Washington University School of Medicine, associate professor with the Department of Psychiatry. A lot of published research to his name on this topic, and also is the director of the Washington Early Recognition Clinic. The abbreviation for that is WERC, W-E-R-C. If you want to know more about this, you can look it up on the internet. You can look up, I think, work.woustl.edu. So W-E-R-C.W-U-S-T-L.edu. This is a really cool website, lots of cool research there.
Yeah.
So, I guess where we left off, we were talking about early intervention. And so one thing you said is, we think that if you catch the psychosis earlier and do something about it sooner, that probably people will have a much better outcome. Is that what we're thinking here?
Well, it's more than what we're thinking. I mean, there's a lot of research that kind of shows that if you're able to intervene early, you know, soon as the disorder first develops, when you look 10, 20 years into the future, the outcomes tend to be a lot better in terms of their ability to function, their vocational outcomes, their social outcomes tend to be much better. And, you know, and that's the reason that we have clinics like this, because, you know, we are really trying to get people in early so that we can preserve a lot of their life in the most positive way.
Right. Yeah. I guess it's almost as if when somebody is psychotic, there's some kind of damage going on, either to their life or their brain or both. And so the earlier you do something about that, the better it's going to be.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I know one thing that I guess that you guys focus on in the clinic, and one thing I've heard about is they talk about prodromal symptoms, like people who are going to be psychotic, but they're not quite psychotic yet, or you're not sure if they're psychotic, but they have.
Right.
Can you tell me about that? What kind of signs are there that someone's going to be psychotic or someone's developing a psychosis? What do you see for that?
So typically, you know, somewhere between, you know, several years to several weeks before the onset of a psychotic disorder, most people tend to have these prodromal symptoms. And, you know, what they are is a sort of attenuated form of a psychotic disorder experience.
Uh-huh.
So they may begin to start having a change in their behavior, but it's not as severe as what you would see in a full-blown schizophrenia. So you may have an experience where someone would start hearing voices, but maybe not as frequently, or maybe they're beginning to be suspicious. So something is changing, or you know their school performance is beginning to fall, or they're beginning to be more socially isolated. So it's kind of similar to a full blown schizophrenia, but it's a lot less severe.
And I guess a lot of those symptoms might sort of overlap with other things, because some of those symptoms sounded like depression, or maybe they're smoking too much pot or something like that.
Right. Yeah. And the thing is, so that's the other thing. So the prodrome oftentimes is characterized by specifically those things that you mentioned, depression, anxiety. There's a lot of drug use.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes this kind of leads family members to assume that, well, this is all related to something else.
Oh, right.
When in fact there may be a psychotic process going on.
Oh, right. Like someone might be developing schizophrenia, and the family might say, oh, they're just depressed, you know, and get them an antidepressant or something like that. Right.
Absolutely. It can be really hard to tell. It's not easy.
Not easy to tell the difference. And I guess it's one of those things that as time goes on, it probably gets obvious later, but at the moment you might not know. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. And I know that, so you're not only treating patients there, but you're also doing research to try to get a better understanding of what causes psychosis and what you can do to treat it. Let's talk just a little bit about treatment, because I'll bet most of the listeners don't know. Can you kind of give us a brief summary? So someone is psychotic. What do you do to make them better, and how much do those treatments work?
Yeah, so it's going to be very individual specific.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, generally, when people have a full-blown psychotic disorder, like, say, schizophrenia or, you know, psychotic bipolar, typically, most people would be on an antipsychotic type of medication,
mm-hmm.
and there are several out there. But of course, depending on the specific presentation of that, sometimes there are other medications that may be needed to target anxiety or depression or some other related symptoms. So medication is a very important part of treatment. There are also other treatments involving counseling or psychotherapy So like individual psychotherapy, oftentimes is very helpful, as well as group therapies and family therapies have been shown to have a lot of effectiveness.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So, so those sort of talk therapies are helpful, but it sounds like, you know, you can't talk someone out of their voices. You know, they definitely need medication, not just the counseling. Right. Yeah.
Particularly if they have a more severe case.
Right.
So I think we have to kind of be careful. If somebody has a full blown schizophrenia or psychotic bipolar, almost always they would need to be on a medication. Now, if you are in the prodromal stage, it would really depend on the specific symptoms that you have and how severe they are. A lot of people would require medication, but some may not.
Right.
So it's very variable.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. And how about the research you guys are doing there?
Yeah.
What can you... Can you tell the listeners about your research, preferably using small words?
Okay. Yeah, well, first of all, I want to say that, you know, the clinic is primarily a treatment clinic. So the research kind of comes a distant second. But it's still something that we think is really important, because we're trying to think beyond the existing treatments that are available for psychotic individuals.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, the question is, you know, how can in the future, how can we try to make better treatments available for people? So one of the things that we do is brain imaging, and we're hoping to kind of ramp that up. So, you know, there are a lot of cutting edge new brain imaging that can really give us a lot of information about how the brain functions, how the brain looks like. And we know that in people with psychotic disorders, there are often very prominent abnormalities. So the question is, can we use that information in the future to try to personalize treatment? Can we identify people that may react better to specific types of treatment on what their brain profile is? Can we also monitor brain changes with treatment to make sure that we're doing the right thing and we're trying to correct those abnormalities that may be present?
So depending on their brain scan, you might be able to determine what treatment works best for which people and do the right thing
Absolutely.
For each individual. So it's not just all about finding out why people get psychotic. It's also all about finding the best way to fix it. So what has science discovered? Why do people get psychotic? I know you don't actually know the answer to that question, but I thought it would be fun to ask.
It's an important question. There's a lot that we know about schizophrenia and psychosis, but, you know, there's a lot that we don't know. And that's the whole point of research, is trying to learn more. But we do know a lot, right? So, you know, one thing, for example, that we know is that there's a really strong genetic component to schizophrenia, right? So it tends to cluster in families. You know, if you have a thing, or you have a parent or a grandparent with schizophrenia, then you're going to be more likely to develop a psychotic disorder in the future.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that, you know, the genetic component is really a really important driver in who gets schizophrenia. But it's not the only explanation, right? So, for example, if you look at identical twins, for example, right, they share 100% of their genes.
Yeah.
But the concordance between monozygotic twins or identical twins is only about 50%.
Right. Yeah.
So we know that genetics does play a major role, but it doesn't explain everything.
Right. Yeah. Genetics are big, but it's a lot less than 100%. So, yeah.
Right. Right. So, you know, we know that there are, you know, there has to be other kinds of environmental effects that contribute to who gets it and who doesn't.
Yeah. So that's where a lot of the research is now, I guess, like what kind of environmental effects might influence whether or not someone gets psychosis, and also, and also which parts of the brain are malfunctioning in psychosis.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Huh. And I guess for this clinic, so I guess let me make sure the listeners know the website. The website is Work, but it's W-E-R-C, but very clever name there, W-E-R-C, dot Wustl, W-U-S-T-L, dot edu. And I guess if people can't memorize that, I don't know, should they look up Dr. Mama psychosis or something like that? What's the best way?
That may take you there. I think it may be easier to just Google Washington Early Recognition Center.
Yeah.
And I believe I'm the only one in the world with that name. So, our clinic is the only one. So I think it should be able to take you there. No problem.
Yeah. And Dr. Mama, it's spelled M-A-M-A-H. So if you look up Dr. Mama, Washington University, for the Washington Early Recognition Center. So if anyone has, a family member or someone they know who's young, what's the age range there?
Yeah, so we see people between ages 13 and 25.
13 and 25. Okay. All right.
Yes.
All right. Oh, and Chad's giving us the signal that we've got to wrap up. Oh, and there's the music in the background. So we learned all about psychosis in early life. Dr. Mama, thank you so much for doing this.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think the listeners are going to love this. So thank you so much for being on the radio, and I'll let you go back to doing your science stuff.
All right, thank you for having me.
You bet. Yeah, you betcha. All right, have a good one.
Bye.
All right.
You
bye-bye.
Too.
Thanks. All right, bye.
You're listening to The Medical Beat.
All right, here we are. We're gonna switch gears now. Now we have our guest is Dr. Robert Becker. You might all remember that Dr. Becker was on the show a few weeks ago. Dr. Becker is a PhD psychologist who's in practice here in the St. Louis area, author of a couple books that sold really well. One's called Addicted to Misery. The other book is Don't Talk, Don't Trust, and Don't Feel. Clever titles. I'll have to actually read the book sometime there, Dr. Becker.
unless you want to stay miserable and not talk.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good. But yeah. So Dr. Becker and I are going to talk today about a whole bunch of stuff, but I think especially we're going to talk about people's mental health during this whole mess we've got going on now with the pandemic and the economic problems and all of that. But I guess the first thing I want to ask Rob here is so with the pandemic going on, I guess you don't have your patients coming to the office for their therapy anymore. Can you tell me how are you working as a psychologist when you're not having people come to your office? How are you doing your job recently? How's that going?
Well, what myself and one of my partners and the rest of the people in the group decided to do was about the first part of March, the handwriting was on the wall. There was just too many potential risk for us and for our families and for the patients to come sit in a waiting room. So we decided to go virtual, and we have been virtual with all of my patients since the first week of March. And as new patients come in that want to be seen, they're told that, I'm only doing virtual visits at this point. And I'm just amazed at how well it's worked out. I think really what it is that, frankly, I think people like to be able to stay in their pajamas and talk to their psychologist. That's my feeling. They don't have to get dressed and, gussy up and show up in my office and drive.
Right.
So plus they're safe.
Right.
It's been a great experience, and I can't even begin to tell you how well it's received.
So in general, the clients like it. The clients sort of like it better than going to see you in person, it sounds like.
Yeah, I think so. In fact, I can tell you since March, which is about, I guess, 5 months ago, that I've had in the group of people that I work with, I've had only one person that is asked a couple of times, are you going back to your office soon, Doc? And I go, not really, not at this point. We just can't, we can't do that. The worst part of all of this is we're all still having to pay rent on those offices that we're not in.
Oh, right. You're still paying rent.
Yeah. They didn't let us out of that trick.
Right. Oh, so you have those empty offices there, right?
Yeah, I go there to get mail and look for files if I'm missing one at my house.
Right.
And to reestablish virtually an office in my home as a virtual space.
Right.
And it's really worked out well.
Yeah. So the patients are seeing you while they're in their pajamas. When you're working, are you in your pajamas?
Oh, no. But they only see me from my waist up, so,
okay.
You know, I could be in anything.
Right.
Really.
Yeah. I'm not even going to ask about waist down. Let's just not go there.
I completely dress. There's never a problem.
Okay.
And it doesn't matter. I'm always there.
Oh, okay. Good. Glad. I'm so, the audience is relieved to hear that. Good. Okay. Right.
Yeah.
So what do you think? So, I mean, let's say in the future the pandemic's over. Are you going to want to keep on doing it remotely? Did you like it now, or would you want to go back to seeing people in person? How's that going to work?
Well, you know, at this point, I don't know. For me personally, this has been really an adventure. It took a little while in the beginning for me and people that I was seeing get used to the platforms that we're using. And we've narrowed it down. We just use one platform at this point, and it's pretty bulletproof once you tell them how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there will be some transition back into the office because we've got a lease for a while, at least.
Oh, yeah.
It has to be paid. As well as phone bills and et cetera. So I don't have a problem going back. I have a problem with the potential of how I can ensure that somebody's not going to come in and have the potential of being, you know, asymptomatic or they didn't take the vaccine. Mm-hmm. I don't know if the term that when this is over, I don't know that it's ever really going to be over in the sense that you don't have to be concerned if you've got high-risk people involved that you're either living with or working with. So I'm probably going to be doing a combination of two different things, virtual as well as seeing people in the office at some point.
Oh, okay. So you'll probably keep on paying rent then.
I'm paying it anyway. So.
Right, yeah. Yeah. I didn't know. You know, it might make sense just to stop paying rent and be all virtual, you know?
Well, you know, one of the fellows that I work with, he said, boy, you know, if we didn't have to pay rent, that would be it. We're done. We're just staying where we're at our right. Virtual site.
Yeah. And I guess kind of the way you're doing it's pretty similar to everybody else. I guess most psychologists and therapists are seeing people remotely now, as far as I know. Is that the impression you have too?
Yes, absolutely. And even when I get new people that are calling in, you know, and I tell them, listen, I'm only doing this virtual. Oh, that's not a problem. What do we have to do that? And, you know, I explain what we're using as a platform and what I have done with new people is we have a phone conversation briefly to talk about the platform we're using, which is Zoom. And then we do a little trial run and they get a chance to see me and I get a chance to see them. Sometimes we'll exchange photos over the internet to each other so they have a face that they can see before they start this.
Uh-huh.
And then we move on from there.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Sounds like that works really well. Yeah. I remember.
It does, really.
Yeah. I remember I did a little bit of virtual psychiatry before the pandemic and, yeah, I think when I had a similar experience. I like doing it that way, and a lot of the patients liked it too. I guess for psychiatry, when it's a lot of its medications, it was kind of different. But a lot of my patients are, you know, they're doing just fine, and they really enjoyed having just a, you know, a short visit over the internet, and they can say, "Hey, I'm doing fine," and they can answer a few of my questions, and they're like, "Yeah, that thank you, that's it," you know, and they wanted that short visit, and what they did not want to do is drive all the way to my office just to sit there for a few minutes and say, "Yeah, I feel fine, thanks. Can I have my refills?" You know, so virtual's good, yeah.
You know, that concerns me that potentially some of the people that I know that drive from pretty good distances out in Wentzville or over in Illinois and come over to my office, my concerns is they may tell me that they're not going to be able to or they're not going to want to come over since this works so well for them. And, you know, they just have found this to be just really good. They don't have an issue with it at all.
Right.
And, you know, that's how this has been going for me, at least.
Yeah. Yeah. But I guess since a lot of these are people who you were already seeing before the pandemic and now you're seeing them during the pandemic, how is the pandemic affecting your psychology clients? How are people doing with it?
Well, they have a number of things that are related to this, some of them more than others. Mm-hmm. I think the biggest issue that they're struggling with is the confinement, kind of being at home, or as I call it, they get stuck in this notion that life isn't going to be the same for them ever again. And that's a big issue. They define themselves, I call it being in the cone of COVID, if you will,
yeah.
Where they see this as encapsulating them. And then when you break it down and you start talking about the things that they did before this, a lot of the things that they did before, they can still do now if they just use some good common sense. And that's a significant piece. The only other real major issue that they're dealing with besides, you know, the anxiety and the depression that they would have anyway is the anger. They just, some of them are extremely angry, and they're angry at everybody and everything, including, you know, the government and health people are not getting this done quick enough. And,
yeah.
You know, I try to stay away from the politics and make it much more about, you know, how are we going to cope and get through this over the course of the next whatever time it's going to take.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. Got to stay away from politics when you're seeing therapy patients. You never know.
Boy, you're sure right.
Yeah. Hey, Chad's playing the music, so we're going to take a break for just a little bit, and we're going to be right back. We're talking to Dr. Rob Becker, psychologist in the St. Louis area, talking COVID. We'll be right back.
You're listening to The Medical Beat.
All right, we're back. It's 97.1 FM Talk. You're listening to The Medical Beat. I'm your host, Dr. Steve Harvey, and we have with us here today our guest, Dr. Rob Becker, a psychologist in the St. Louis area, in private practice, also author of a couple of books, Addicted to Misery and Don't Talk, Don't Trust, and Don't Feel. And we're talking COVID. We're talking how people are dealing with COVID or not dealing with COVID, as the case may be. And let's kind of start with that. So can you tell us, Rob, how are people, what are people doing to try to cope with this whole COVID thing and all the stress surrounding that?
Well, you really, you know, Steve, you really have to help them break down these kind of belief systems that they have where they just think, well, this is going to be forever. I'm going to be stuck here for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
And that's just, we know that's not true.
Yeah,
we don't know how long,
yeah,
but it's not true.
The last 3 months does kind of feel like forever, but yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Months,
it does. As I kind of talked a little bit before, I get, you know, I'm not able to do the things that I used to do, and I'm really, you know, upset about that, and my whole routine is terrible, and I don't know what to do, Doc. And I say, well, let's talk about what that routine was and see if we can pick out some things that we might be able to substitute for those, you know, situations that have been previously part of your life. And that's usually not that hard to get them to do that. Once they start thinking about it, they got to get out of this mindset that I'm stuck and this is never going away, because that's just a train ride down the track that you just don't want to go. It keeps you locked up.
Right. It's not forever. It just feels like it, I guess. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Just feels like it.
Right. Yeah. 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 But I guess that's an important thing for people to keep in mind. Is that message working? Does that help, or how's that going? How's that going for you?
You know, once I can break out cognitively, that's the thinking way that they're seeing their irrational belief that I can't have dinner with any friends any longer. Well, that's ridiculous. Of course you can. You just have to do it differently than you've always done it. Yeah. Then they start seeing that, you know, they have been stuck in this belief bubble that is got them like prisoners of, as I say, the prisoners of COVID. Yeah. And it does work. They do get out of that, and they're able to start functioning. And we are in this for some time. I realize that. But we're going to be in it for longer, too.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, and I guess all the, you know, the therapy people that you talk to, is it mostly the not being able to be around other people that bothers them, or the worrying about catching the virus, or what are the main things that are on people's minds? What are the main things bothering them?
What you just said is, you know, not being with people and so forth, being able to get out and do some of the things they did. The biggest thing that's now just absolutely drowning people is this issue of schools. Oh. I have people with kids and they are just conflicted. They can't figure out what to do. They're scared to death about the kids going back to school. They feel the kids have to go to school, but they can't. Yeah. You know, they got grandma living at home and they're afraid that the kid comes back. And there's so many mixed messages that are coming out via the media that they don't know what to believe. You can understand that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, if you look on Facebook or the news or whatever, it's just a mess. It's hard to know. Yeah. And I guess, like you said, as far as going back to school, you know, I mean, going back to school sounds like a terrible option. And not going back to school also sounds like a terrible option. You know?
Well, you know, I have one of my sons is a school teacher, and he's got two little girls. One was supposed to start preschool this, August, early September. And the other one is supposed to go into seventh grade. Well, the way the districts have set this up is they're going to be, if you go virtual all the time, then you're all at home. But then the problem is who's going to watch the kids all 5 days a week.
Yeah.
And if you go with their plans that St. Louis County has developed in the school districts, it's 2 days of actual in-class and 3 days of virtual. Well, how long does it take a kid to contract this virus or become an individual that's going to potentially pass this on or bring it home?
Yeah.
So that's this thing is very, very difficult and complex for people to deal with. And right now, that's the big issue I'm struggling with most people, is helping them get through this, feeling like they're not making the wrong decision.
Yeah, and families, we have to worry about, do I go back to my job, or do I stay home with the kid, and or what, you know? Yeah.
That's universal. I have to tell you, with any of the people I see, and that's at least 50-60% of my patients that I see are all with kids in school, whether they're in elementary or middle school or high school, and even the ones with kids going back to college.
Yeah.
It's all the same. How can we do this? How am I going to do this and not be scared to death that something bad's going to happen?
Right.
So I'm dealing with that fear, and it's a rational fear. It's not irrational. It's real.
Yeah, and it's harder to give someone therapy when the thing that they're afraid of is that real. Yeah, yeah. Oh, but so how, as far as how people are dealing with this, are you seeing like more drinking or overeating, or what kind of stuff are you seeing?
You know, not as a general rule. I don't have a lot of people that are eating their way through this, which is kind of interesting. I would have thought, you know, I might have seen more of that, but I'm not. I've got some people that are probably drinking more than they did before, but they're not ending up in the hospitals or in the treatment facilities. So, and I'm talking with them every single week. I made a decision when this happened that two things. One, I was going to stay in contact with people because I was afraid of what might go on since they weren't seeing somebody or weren't seeing me on a regular basis, that I was going to check in with them, even if it was for 20 or 30 minutes once a week. Every week we've been seeing people.
Oh, yeah.
And I probably have 40 to 50 people a week I'm checking in with, plus the new people that show up.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, hey, before we go, when the pandemic's over, what are you going to do? What are you looking forward to doing before the pandemic's over?
You know, I want to get my kids and my grandkids here that I can give them a hug and that the grandkids can sleep over. And I'm sick of these things called the air hugs. That does me no good at all.
I get no pleasure. Air hugs are the worst. Yeah, real hugs are better. So, all right. Good to know. Hey, Chad's playing the music. That means we got to go. I think that it's been Dr. Rob Becker, psychologist in the St. Louis area. We've been talking about COVID. Thank you so much for being here. Hey, that was great.
You're so welcome. I appreciate it. I'm glad to help whatever I can do.
Yeah, thank you so much. All right, out we go. Have a good one, everybody.